Welcome to Teneo Insights, a podcast that provides in-depth analysis on the issues that matter most to CEOs and their businesses. I'm your host, Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo's political risk advisory business. Let's get started.
Noted author and economist Dambisa Moyo is with me today. She started her career as an economist with the World Bank and subsequently with Goldman Sachs. She is the author of four books, which were New York Times bestsellers, the latest of which was Edge of Chaos in 2018. She was a World Economic Forum global leader, young global leader, and a member of the Time 100. Today, she sits on the boards of Chevron and 3M. And in May, she's got another book coming out called How Boards Work and How They Can Work Better in a Chaotic World, which will resonate with a lot of you on this call today. So I am delighted to have her here on Teneo Insights for the first time. Dambisa, welcome. You've got a lot of hats to wear. We're going to try to get you to wear as many of them as possible here this morning.
Thank you.
A lot of ground to cover. So I want to start, if we can, with the big economic picture, but with a particular focus on the U.S. I mean, COVID cases and deaths have dropped dramatically from the post-holiday peaks, but we're starting to see plateau at levels that are higher than last summer's second peak. So still over 60,000 cases per day and about 2,000 deaths per day. Vaccines are being rolled out, but obviously not without hiccups and without hesitancy. But President Biden says that all adult Americans will be able to get vaccinated by the end of May. States are reopening, though federal officials suggest that may be prematurely. But more stimulus is obviously on the way. So how are you assessing the economic outlook here in early March?
Well, first of all, thank you, Kevin, for hosting me. I'm delighted to be here. I look forward to comments and questions. And, I think it's wonderful to be able to connect at a time where there's so many questions, still so many questions, and perhaps a lot of sort of risk around the answers. At a very high level, I would put it this way. We, as everyone knows, have been dealing with a multifaceted, multi-period problem. What you've outlined, Kevin, has largely focused on the health aspect of the COVID problem. As an economist and as a business person, our purview has tended to be really quite focused on the aggregate demand shock that we experienced, the shutdown, and really trying to now figure out how does this look in terms of a rebound. It's worth saying, and I should at the onset say that my fundamental view is that we will, and we are already seeing a rebound, but fundamentally, for a whole host of reasons, which I'll outline in a moment, we are not seeing quite yet a recovery. And I think that the context here in terms of the delineation is that even before COVID hit in 2020 in earnest, the global economy was already addressing or dealing with many structural challenges, which I had highlighted in my book, Edge of Chaos, that you mentioned from 2018. I won't delve into details because people will be familiar with a lot of them. But just in terms of at a very high level, structural economic growth was on a path of decline, including rates of return. So if you look at the IMF World Economic Outlook, this is a report that they put out twice a year in April and in October. The 2014 World Economic Outlook, the IMF said that they did not expect the global economy to ever see the rates of growth that we had seen prior to 2008. In a similar vein, we've had companies like McKinsey in 2015 had forecasted that the global economy growth rate in the next 50 years would be half of the global economy growth rates in the prior 50 years. And a lot of that, we know what has happened, and I'll again come to those specific points in a moment. But it's not just that the growth forecasts and the equity return forecasts had collapsed to relatively low levels. And just as a rule of thumb, in order for a country to double per capita incomes in a generation, so by that really putting a dent in poverty, you need to be growing at 3% per year. Before COVID hit, the United Kingdom in 2019 was growing at between 1.2 and 1.4%. Germany, Q4 2019, was growing at 0%. If you start to look at the large major emerging market economies, so these are the economies that have at least 50 million people, Brazil, Argentina, South Africa, Russia, et cetera, they were all growing far below that 3%. Many of them had just started to emerge from recessions. So the global picture, as well as the United States, of course, the U.S. President Trump was always trumpeting how the U.S. was above that 3% magic number. But even now, if you look at the forecasts, real deterioration, most of these economies will probably grow no more than around 2% over the next decade. But if I may just take a moment to talk about these headwinds, which have been catalyzed or have been made worse by the arrival of COVID. They include risk of job losses because of technology, so what's called technological unemployment. We will come back to that because boards, in terms of our allocating of capital, a real big issue right now is digitization, but that has been on the table for a while. Some of the forecasts in 2013 were that half of the U.S. economy would be automated, including job losses by 2030. Demographic shifts, enormous shifts, both in terms of the quality and the quantity of the world's population. There are about 8 billion of us now. The world's population will continue to grow at a clip until there are 11 billion of us by 2100, according to the United Nations. This is massively skewed towards the young in the emerging markets, where 60 to 70% of the population is under the age of 25. Real issues in terms of the workforce that's been produced. OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, has talked about how this generation of Americans, for the first time in the history of the country, is less educated than the preceding generation. The consequences of that in an economy that's becoming less manufacturing and services-based and more automated and tech-based are enormous, as we know. Issues of income inequality and the breakdown of social mobility, well known. Just to put a number on it, the U.S. Social mobility, the sort of assumption, the probability of being born in a low-income household and ending your life in a high-income household has gone down by 50% in the past three decades. We don't know, as economists, how to solve income inequality. We've tried left-leaning policies such as a tax and redistribution, which are very popular in Europe. That has not worked. We have tried more right-leaning policies, sort of the supply side, low taxation, with the hope of expanding the GDP pie. That has also not worked. So we're really looking for a real considerable innovation in terms of thinking, and we can talk a little bit about some of the things that people are working on. Natural resources and climate change, again, seen as many as a big concern, massive headwind before COVID. It's even a bigger issue now with regarding trade-offs. I mean, where do you put your marginal dollar? Is it towards vaccinations or is it towards combating climate change? One of the problems, particularly for emerging countries, which, by the way, are not ring-fenced in a world of pandemics, but ultimately means whatever we do in the U.S. regarding pandemics is not good enough as long as out there, 90%, where 90% of the world's population lives in the emerging markets, people are still vulnerable and can still transport new strains. So we needed a global approach, and that hasn't happened. Very quickly, the debt levels. Again, something we know, even again, before COVID, before these enormous stimulus packages, the Congressional Budget Office was warning that the United States would have unsustainable entitlement programs by 2050. And that's a report that was coming out in 2016. So that situation, like an option expiry, has become much more of a concern in a much shorter period. So I'll just end off by saying one other thing, that, you know, this confluence of factors has been made more challenged, of course, by by COVID catalyzing the sort of speed and aggressiveness of many of these issues in terms of debt, in terms of the risk of putting climate change in the back foot, et cetera. But the perhaps bigger worry we have as economists and people interested in public policy is that the response, the toolkit in terms of public policy response is clearly largely impotent. And by that, I mean monetary policies that we know has already been negative rates, low rates, and we'll come to inflation because obviously we've seen a move in the 10-year recently. But, you know, fundamentally, we've been in an incredibly low rate environment, and fiscal policies, although have been jump-started, have raised concerns that we end up much more looking like Japan. May I just say one point about inflation, and then I'll take a pause to have you react to what I've said, which is to comment on inflation. If you look at disaggregated numbers, at an aggregate level, you've heard what the Fed has said with respect to, you know, monitoring it, but I would say they're not deeply concerned. But if you look at disaggregated numbers, and by that I mean separating health and education from transportation, telecommunications, even food production, there is a clear there's clear evidence that there is inflation buildup in the system. Healthcare, and by the way, I'm happy, Kevin, if you're interested, I can send you a chart of this. But over time, there's enormous inflationary pressures, price changes in both healthcare and education, and those are forecast to continue given the environment we're in. But there has been massive deflation in telecommunications, in transportation, in food production, largely due to technology. Now, having said that, notwithstanding what I've just said, we are in many locales starting to see a pickup in inflation in things like paper and wood pulp and transportation and logistics. As a publisher, as an author, my publishing house is concerned because a lot of printing companies have gone out of business, as one example. And, you know, there's a lot of buildup in aggregate demand, which we expect to come online because of the vaccination. But that is not being supported by aggregate supply in a lot of these areas. So I am I'm more concerned about inflation perhaps than others. I'm seeing it in many different hallways. And I think that we are discounting inflation because we tend to look at it in a very aggregated way and not in a disaggregated way. I'll stop here for a moment, Kevin, and then we can continue.
So there's a lot there. And let's try to unpack some of this because so on the one hand, you have laid out a very clear picture with regards to structural headwinds that the global economy is facing. And you made the remark that we're seeing the green shoots of rebound, if not recovery. But you also talk about the challenges that we have seen from different policy responses through the years, both liberal and more conservative approaches that have had their limitations in terms of the results. But obviously, we're in a situation where policymakers can't do nothing. So, oftentimes during the pandemic, there has been the wartime analogy made, and the sort of the re-rise of the sort of Keynesian response mechanism, right? So throw as much money as needed at this. I guess I'd like to know your take on that kind of a fiscal response. Obviously, right now we're waiting for the president's $1.9 trillion proposal to make its way through Congress. But coming on the heels as it does from the stimulus measures or survival measures, if you want to call it that, from last year, in aggregate, these numbers are enormous versus the overall size of the economy. What is your assessment, of this? Why $1.9 trillion? Is it kind of a Goldilocks number? I mean, why is it not more? Why is it not less? I guess, will it do, in your view, what it is meant to do, given where we are on the health recovery continuum?
Well, so I hear two questions in there. One is a look back, a historical look back to, perhaps what the shape of a recovery might look like based on what we've seen in the past and the role of government. And perhaps I'll come back to that. Let me start off with what I think is the second question, which is kind of here and now, what is likely to happen on the back of this enormous stimulus? And, very fortuitously, I've been in a number of conversations with people who are close to the administration, but also people who are on the other side of the aisle, parts of the same group, but are deeply concerned. And I'll say they're concerned for two fundamental reasons. One is that it's not entirely clear how the money will be spent. So if you look back, the stimulus package last year, the checks that people received, there was a sense that, and in fact, in economics, there's this Ricardian theory that when people get a windfall check like that, they're not dumb. They understand that, wait a second, and sometime in the future, the government's is going to tax us, so we'll put this money away. But that is not what seems to have happened. People seem to have spent some of that money in perhaps ways, I mean, there's data out there, in perhaps ways that were not going to be sustainable. And I think a lot of us had the framing that it was going to be a short, sort of shock to the system. We were all going to be back home back out and working and back into our daily lives by the summer. And I think that that was the approach and the attitude towards the checks that was received last year. So part of the question is where does this money get spent? How does it get spent? Is it going to be just to put a band-aid on people's living, or is it going to be invested? And we're seeing a lot of movement in real estate, for example. People are trying to figure out whether we're going to see a sort of a jumpstart in more structural fundamental assets and how people are thinking about opportunities for investment and longer term. I don't want to overplay that it's $1,400, so I don't want to make a big deal of it, but that's one fundamental question. The second question, which people like Larry Summers have highlighted, is that it might be too much of a stimulus. And not only are we worried about inflationary effects, but more fundamentally, if this doesn't work, politically, what happens next? And we will know the answer to that, i.e. whether it's worked, whether the economy is sort of back on fire, really by the autumn months. Come September, October, I think we'll have much more visibility. As you pointed out, the vaccines will have been rolled out. People will be back. There are lots of questions. Are people going to sort of rush out, go to restaurants and movie theaters? Maybe once, but maybe we've all been retrained to stay home and we won't be bothered, maybe not bothered to go out for a second or third time. So those are open questions. And as I said, it's not just about the economics of it, of whether the stimulus, how it will be spent, but much more fundamentally around the politics. If this does not work, we could end up in a political impasse and have no more bullets really to spend, given this Congressional Budget Office and some of the debt issues. As you know, China is the, if not first, because they interchange with Japan, the second largest foreign lender to the United States, which has made the debt story less of an economics question and financial question and much more of a geopolitical question, which, again, I think we'll come to. But if I may go to your first question and look back in history to talk a little bit about, what we might see next and what we can learn from history. And I've spent an inordinate amount of time on this question in the past year. And to my mind, the best example of the recent history is the Gilded Age, which is the period between 1870 and 1900 in the United States. Very much like the period of 1950 to 2008, these are two periods that are characterized by high economic growth, a massive globalization in trade, in the movement of capital, movement of people in terms of immigration, in terms of global standards, and global cooperation. So those are absolutely a hallmark of both the Gilded Age and this period of 1950 to 2008. These are also periods of relatively laissez-faire government. Government is seen as sort of stepping in when there are crises, not really involved in the economy. These are also periods of massive income inequality, widening income inequality. The Gilded Age, as we know, was punctured by three things. We had at the turn of the century, to 1900, we had World War I, which was 1914 to 1918. Quickly on the heels of that, the Spanish flu, 1918 to 1920. And then we had the stock market crash of 1929, which led to a global recession, which people know. Perhaps what many might not know or might not remember in terms of their history lessons, the period from 1930 to 1954 was a complete 25-year reversal of the Gilded Age. By that, I mean this period of 25 years is characterized by low economic growth and high unemployment, complete unwind of globalization. You have a period of Smoot-Hawley that emerges. Immigration is completely undermined. By the way, Smoot-Hawley was legislatures in the United States government who imposed tariffs on thousands of goods. We also had immigration. I should just again to give you some numbers. The percentage of foreign-born people in the United States is about 14% today. It was about 14% in the Gilded Age, towards the end of the Gilded Age. There was a dip in the period I'm talking about to down to 6%. So immigration was also really largely shut down. But also, we saw massive government intervention. So government becomes a big player, putting in a lot of public policy initiatives such as FDIC and Social Security to try and combat income inequality. And with that, really also antitrust legislation. And so that was on the back of the Sherman Act, a lot of breakups of Standard Oil, the railway barons, et cetera. Now, some of you might be asking, what does that have to do with where we are today? I think it has to do a lot with where we are today. And one other people, those people who love following the stock market, one other data point is that the Dow Jones Industrial Index peaked in 1929 at 381 points. The Dow Jones Industrial Index did not, again, reach that point of 381 points until 1954. So for 25 years, you're in deep economic malaise, a complete reversal of the policies that had dominated the Gilded Age, as I said. I believe we are headed for a very similar landscape. We have just emerged from 1950 to 2008 of high growth environment. In fact, the average growth rate over that period was about 8% globally. Massive globalization, as we know, in all the pillars of globalization, trade, capital movements, immigration, et cetera. And we also saw, as I said, relatively laissez-faire governments, big corporations, and income inequality widening. I do believe we're now headed for a time that will be characterized by big government. So government is big already. I'm talking about debt and deficits. U.S. debt to GDP, about 100%. Global debt to GDP right now is around 320%. Just to pepper in really quickly here, for those of you who love to follow statistics, have another look at the wonderful book called This Time It's Different by two wonderful economists, Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart. It came out a few years ago. They look at 900 years of government debt, and they conclude that at debt-to-GDP ratios above 60%, your growth declines to around 2%. And if you recall, I mentioned the 3% number being really important to breach. So big government. One other data point really quickly before I go through the other points. Angela Merkel of Germany has lamented very publicly a deep concern that Europe represents just 7% of the world's population, but it's 25% of world GDP, and 50%, half of welfare payments, global welfare payments, are just to Europe. If you add the United States and Europe, you're talking about a 12% of the world's population, 50% of world GDP, and 90% of welfare payments are to the US and Europe. As I touched on earlier, 90% of the world's population lives in the poor emerging markets. She's talked about this imbalance and how this could be very problematic. Some of the other themes I think are going to emerge based on what we saw post-Gilded Age. Government's going to have a much bigger role in the economy as an arbiter of capital and labor. We've seen some of this, the Fed buying, sub-investment grade debt. I think these types of movements are not just going to be emergency movements in the COVID era. I think they're more fundamentally government's going to be playing a bigger role. I believe we'll have fewer corporations, at least publicly traded companies. We've seen that data. Look at the Wilshire statistics. Over the past 10 years, we've gone from 7,000 companies that are listed down to 3,000 and continuing to see a lot of companies choosing to go private or a lot more consolidation, which leads to the next point. I think we're heading for a period of much more taxation, much more regulation. Pretty much every sector, banking, technology, airlines, pharmaceuticals, energy companies have ended up as oligopolies. And much like the Sherman Act and antitrust, I think government is agitating to try and break up. So I think because of these natural oligopolies that have emerged, I think we'll see more of that. And then the last point, Kevin, before I stop here, is that we're already seeing deglobalization in trade and capital, immigration standards with the splinternet, the risk that China will have its own competing intellectual platform, as well as a breakdown of global cooperation, multilateralism. We saw that before COVID. I think we'll see much more of that, even regardless of the fact that the U.S. is basically claiming to be back and much more engaged. China, very last point, is now the leading foreign direct investor, leading trading partner, and leading debt lender to many countries, developed and developing around the world. In fact, it is now the largest debtor to, largest lender to a number of emerging countries, in fact, to the emerging world, bigger than the Paris Club, bigger than the IMF, bigger than the World Bank. So we're seeing this live, and I think China will continue to play a big role. Let me stop there.
Well, I've been drinking my coffee over here while you gave that, but given the sobering assessment, I might have to move on to something harder here. I want to pivot a little bit because, you know, your background obviously is was spent on looking at a lot of the emerging markets when you were as a professional economist. And, you know, I want to get your take on what all of this means. I mean, you've touched on that a bit here. For the rest of the world, but particularly with emerging markets. I mean, you're talking about, you know, this all of these headwinds. You're talking about the pent up inflation that's out there. Talking about the debt overhang and these pending obligations that the Western world has on its on their welfare systems. And I'm wondering here. We saw this scare in bond markets last week. This kind of reemergence of inflationary concern, even though the Fed continues to insist that it's willing to let the economy run hot and so on and so forth. But given that the emerging markets don't have the fiscal space that the Western world does, given that they are behind in terms of getting the vaccine allocations and therefore disbursements. Are you concerned that we could have a situation where, you know, you get this more aggregate V-shaped recovery in the developed world? It forces the Fed and the other major central banks to act and to actually tighten before the emerging market economies have been able to catch up, and we've got a new crisis on that front.
Yes, absolutely. Here's the way I would headline this. I would say it's really important that we understand that the emerging markets crisis, whatever that may look like, is not an emerging markets crisis. It's a global economy crisis. There's no way that 90% of the world's population can be in an environment of slow vaccine rollouts, massive contraction, ongoing contraction economically, and not be felt through trade and global commerce and many other avenues, risks of other pandemics, et cetera, for the rest of the world. If you look at the World Bank statistics, this COVID pandemic has actually sent 150 million people back into into extreme poverty, which is a big deal because for 20 years, we've only seen improvements. The other aspect of this, which is just not, it's not just an economic problem, and with all that, you know, that portends in terms of civil unrest, et cetera. But I think it's also a geopolitical problem because what that means is that there will be an opening, as I alluded to a moment ago, for China to step in and become a much bigger player. And I don't think, given the urgency of the immediacy of the COVID and the vaccine rollout, we're spending enough time thinking about the important, which is basically what does the world look like? Is the world going to bifurcate, become much more balkanized and in that sense siloed? And what does that mean for business, which is an area that, you know, maybe we'll touch on in a moment, that I'm thinking about as business people responsible for businesses, business leaders, what is our hedge for a world where China becomes ever more dominant, not just in China, but globally? How does that play out for our ability to run global businesses, everything from supply chains and trade, but also our ability to do the carry trade, borrow money in New York and London and invest in Brazil and South Africa for higher risk-adjusted returns. I mean, all our modeling and our purview regarding how the world works has been basically colored by the last 50 years. And what I would like to emphasize is that what we have seen in terms of globalization, in terms of market capitalism and liberal democracy, has actually only been around for 1% of human history. The general trend line is for much more siloed, much more competitive than cooperative. And I fear that a lot of corporations and institutions more generally are just not thinking long and hard about this environment where the emerging world sort of splinters off and causes a lot of problems because we're just not as ring-fenced as we would like to think.
So I want to shift to your new book since you brought it up in a moment here. But one question I want to ask sort of goes back to your old books, right? Which is, you know, in How the West Was Lost back in 2010 and Edge of Chaos in 2018, you discussed, you know, the failures of the rich Western democracies, and you've discussed that at length here. I wonder if you could take a look at from the other perspective. So how has, you know, China obviously has been a juggernaut economically, strategically, and now, you know, Xi Jinping is emerging from, you know, Deng Xiaoping's, you know, wait and bide your time. He is putting it on the world stage in a very significant way. But when you go beyond the headlines, you know, and especially in this pandemic era, has China squandered this opportunity, or is it really, for lack of a better term, capitalizing on that opportunity from your perspective?
So really quickly, China, the way I think about China now, China is where the United States was in the 1950s. So real big, really a stamping of an imprimatur by the government. Government is heavily involved in all aspects, key sectors, which is why I thought the Biden administration announcement last week about, re-looking at industrial sectors. I mean, in America, it's probably sort of sacrilege to call it an industrial policy plan, but really that's what it is. Looking at the different industries, some banking, industrials, technology, et cetera, and trying to figure out how to support these industries. That's what the United States did in the past. The Manhattan Project, all the rollout of Silicon Valley, et cetera, it was really big government ideas. I'm not saying, you know, squeezing out the private sector. They were hand in hand in partnership to develop these programs. That's where China is today. China, this is not the first time that China's been potentially the largest economy in the world. They were the largest economy in the 1700s. If you look at the Angus Madison data, They put in some catastrophic policies and it's cost them 300 years. I don't think they're going to make that mistake again. What I want to make sure that people understand, I'm not at all saying, you know, I'm such a Sinophile or that I'm not recognizing that the United States has a good hand. I do think on a relative basis, the United States has the ability and the flexibility to to reshape and to change direction. And it's urgently warranted right now. But I, at the same time, I don't want people to think that this is the end of the world and, you know, it's a disaster. I think fortunes are going to be made. Even in the boardroom, I worry a lot that we spend a lot of time thinking about risk downside and not enough about upside leverage. You know, environment is one example of this. Everybody talks about CO2 emissions and greenhouse gases and water intensity, and all of that is critically important. But very rarely is there enough of a conversation about where the opportunities are for new product lines, new businesses. And I think government should be leading in that. To bring it back to China, I think if you have, and I have, I spent a lot of time, I've been fortunate enough to spend time with even President Xi Jinping on a number of occasions as a part of a group that I, I'm involved with based here in the United States. But their conversation is for sure risk identification, but very quickly looking at things from a lens of, okay, how do we solve this in a sort of upside leverage, upside opportunity, upside way. I don't have to harp on short-termism. We know about those concerns. And I think certainly in the private sector, we've tried to address short-termism to a great deal. But, you know, in essence, I wouldn't necessarily bet against the United States. I do think Western portfolios, pension funds have far too little exposure to China, given where I think China is. I think the average is around 2%. I think it should be closer to 15% myself.
Let's pivot to your new book, How Boards Work. So, you know, especially within the context of everything you've been talking about and corporate America, for all of its attempts to break away from short-termism, is still constrained by a quarterly earnings cycle and a two-year congressional election cycle, et cetera. So give us a sense of that you can to of the assertions of your new book and your conclusions.
Well, you know, I think the fundamental assertion is that the board structure has been in place since the 1700s. You know, on the one hand, it's due for a refresh in a sensible way. I do think it's fundamentally the right governance structure to have at the helm a handful of people who provide oversight, not just in the traditional support of financial shareholders, but very much as Business Roundtable. And as we know, moving away from that Milton Friedman view to think about the broader utility in society. But it's worth just emphasizing that this is a board have a play a critical role for corporations. I believe, you know, I was looking at some of the data in the United States, the largest Fortune companies actually employ 30 million people. Their revenues are two-thirds of U.S. GDP. It's critically important that we get this right. You know, I go beyond just discussing the fundamental mandate of the board, which is obviously oversight of strategy, selecting the CEO, and then this whole cultural frontier, which I will say in the 10 years that I've served on boards has really been quite a ride. It wasn't that big a deal when I first joined 10 years ago. Now it's right at the heart. And by cultural frontier, I'm talking about not just diversity and inclusion and issues around environment. I'm talking about real challenges that make it difficult and challenging to be a board member. Things like worker advocacy, data privacy issues, competitiveness in a world where, you know, pay equity and gender equity, things that may on the surface seem obvious that are simply not obvious. They require big trade-offs and that boards are being much more required to address. I like, and I quote President Obama, that by the time these things are in the inbox, were in his inbox, it means that they were very difficult and not easy. And the fact that the board is dealing with not just succession and strategy, but also this cultural frontier should tell us all that these are hard questions that boards are dealing with. The last thing I'll just say is, you know, obviously we know that there's a suite of headwinds that the global economy and companies are dealing with, but that also requires that boards evolve, and whether that's around having ethics committees or thinking more strategically about how they do their role on strategy and succession, I detail a handful of proposals on how to make boards better.
So let's, you know, obviously there's a lot to unpack with regards to what you just said. I want to focus on diversity for just a second, because there's been a lot of movement. Teneo itself has been very involved in this through our leadership on BDAA with a number of our senior advisors and the like. And that's been focused a lot on, say, racial diversity. Clearly, there's a gender diversity drive as well. But, you know, you talk a lot about the unprecedented nature of the, you know, of the headwinds that we're facing, and that the change that is going on in the world. Frankly, going through something right now that nobody who's in a position of power and influence has actually ever gone through before, this, you know, this period also with the supplanting of the United States by China, ultimately as the largest economy in the world, and so on and so forth. And so levels of experience now mean different things when you're entering into truly new territory and disruptive territory. So do you think that corporate America is doing a good enough job at diversifying, in every sense of the word, their boards and leaderships overall?
Well, look, my board colleagues will tell you, I pound the table that I think we should be much more ambitious. I think corporations have a number of levers that they haven't pulled on over the past several decades that I think they are going to be called to pull on. I'll give you a specific example. You know, throughout my career on Wall Street, people always talked about retaining and hiring and attracting diverse candidates. But, you know, we are able as businesses to say, you know what, we have an annual conference in Tampa or in Chicago or in Indiana, wherever, take your pick. You know, rather than just write out enormous multimillion dollar checks, why don't we put pressure and demand that S&P and Moody's or somebody gives us a ranking or data on how these municipalities and jurisdictions are performing on everything from education, criminal justice, healthcare, and just improvements in their citizens' livelihoods. I think we can then start to influence a lot more change. And then, of course, there are lots of other areas. We shouldn't just be thinking about how we hire. We should also be thinking about our subcontractors. What is the definition of an employee? I've written recently in Harvard Business Review about this expanding role of what an employee, what it means to be an employee. I think that companies can look towards the suppliers and subcontractors, our advisors as accountants and lawyers, and to say, hey, wait a second, we want to see much more diversity, not just in race and gender, but in thinking and thought. That's the only way we're going to be competitive. Very often, my husband often talks about this idea of leading a great sports team. In a sports team, you want the best talent. You want the people who are going to make your team an A team. And the good news is that the talent is out there in diverse packaging. I think we've just haven't done a very good job at attracting and ensuring that talent is part and parcel of the problem solving that is going to be required. I'll say one very last thing, Kevin, which is why this has become a board issue, is that it's not just about pursuing diversity at the expense of other groups, for example, white men. I think it's about pulling the whole team, the whole organization together, and they should not be an either or. We are about, creating the muscles and the efficiencies to create the best and most competitive teams so that they are able to succeed over the long term. And that's the custodial role of the board.
So you sit on the boards of both Chevron and 3M, two iconic major blue chip companies. You know, how do you, I mean, and both of those companies are in the midst of and in some sense at the tip of the spear of all of these issues that you're talking about. They're multinational corporations, so they're affected by all of this globally. How are you and your colleagues on these boards in this environment really maintaining the level of knowledge and forward thinking that you need to be able to bring to that boardroom on everything from, you know, all of the near term concerns, but also the bigger aspirational concerns that are encompassed in, say, umbrella concepts like ESG as an example, or when you look at what is happening throughout our society as a result of pandemic and what it's doing to education and so on and so forth, that we're this kind of human capital infrastructure deficit is going to continue to build, which will have impact on you and your employees for years to come. How do you remain as informed and educated on all of these issues so that you can work with the management of these incredibly complex organizations?
Well, I'm sure you're tempted for me to say we hired Teneo. On a serious note, look, I take a very, and this links into what I was saying a moment ago, I take a very sort of obvious view about what's going to be important in the next 50 years. To me, it's just clear. China is going to be important. Technology is going to be important, not just in terms of consumerism and social media, much more in terms of public goods, healthcare, education, ability to increase efficiencies. And then, of course, green, the whole climate change agenda. So when I think about this, that's how I look at the lens of hiring. It goes back to the team. Who is it? And for me, I really like this idea of a T-shaped board member. Board members who have the broad enough knowledge and understanding to sort of block and tackle on things that boards have to do. We have to sign off on financials. We have to oversee the strategy. We have to pick a CEO, et cetera. But at the same time, bringing in that expertise, that the bottom part of the T, people who have deep knowledge of what digitization is going to mean. How do we actually transition these organizations to be more automated? I'm not equipped to do that because that's not my background. But also thinking about China, having that perspective. I mean, it's shocking. I talk about this in the book. The percentage of companies in the United States that have very large revenue, you know, over 50% revenue coming from outside the United States, but they don't have any international board members. How can you be competitive in that space in that way? Green economy. It's not just about bringing heretics onto the board to, you know, heckle and scream constantly. It's about constructive dialogue to say, wait a second, let's not lose sight, as I said earlier, about not just risk mitigation, but also upside opportunities. So it really, to me, boils down to the team. Who are the people on the board? Because they know where the sort of bodies are buried in terms of where to get the best sources of information, where to get the best knowledge. And ultimately, it's also about picking the CEO. You know, we have brilliant CEOs running these companies, and they understand these issues. They're at the coalface constantly probing and tapping into different networks to be at that sort of tip of the spear, as you say, on all these major issues that are going to define success or failure in the years to come.
Since I've got you, I want to ask you a little bit narrower question for a second. And that is, there's been a lot made of late of the dearth of both women, people of color, and especially women of color in the economics profession. There are very few economists at the Federal Reserve Banks, as an example, who meet that description. At the same time, you know, I was on a call the other day with Lael Brainard at the Fed, and she brings, you know, a very interesting perspective when she talks about the impact of the pandemic on women specifically, right? Because so many women have effectively left the workforce because of schools being closed and childcare being closed, that they've had to reassert that role of taking care of the family in a sense, and that's going to have long-term implications in the recovery. So, you know, and obviously Gita Gopinath at the IMF is kind of the exception that proves the rule, and you are as well. But how are you in the profession thinking about how do we get more girls and then women who are in college, you know, to get more of them into economics as a field and then into the professional sphere? It's got to start early, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's the classic problem that we face because everybody points at boards, says you don't have enough diversity, points at corporations, you don't have enough diversity. But society itself, you know, and that includes governments, but, you know, civil society, NGOs, we have to all do something much earlier. It's just not good enough to try and put a Band-Aid later on and say, well, or to put a gun to people's heads and say, why have you not addressed this issue? This is systemic. It's multi-generational. But having said that, for people who are looking for women and minorities. Have a look at the Sadie Collective. This is an NGO that basically supports Black women economists. And these institutions exist. I think that we don't do a good enough job of thinking laterally on how we should think about these issues. I mean, if I take myself as an example, I'm deeply gratified to have served not only on Chevron and 3M, but other boards because they did take a flyer. Traditionally, companies have said we only want people from the C-suite. And that, I think, has limited our ability to not only bring in diversity of gender and race, but also of thought. We need people who can help us think through the challenges that are coming. It's the only way that companies will survive longer term. And I think that we just need to be much more flexible about how we think, what kind of athletes we want at the helm of these organizations and essentially driving change, but also driving success longer term, given the ethical challenges, given the risks and the geopolitical economic challenges that we know the world is going to be dealing with.
So going back to this question of boards having that diversity of thought and the civil discourse to think about how to take their institutions to the next move them forward. On the one hand, you know, you've got things like ESG where there's tension from all sides, right? So institutional investors, regulatory measures taken, and boards and companies have to react and they have to fit. But what about things, you know, when you've got, say, large but old companies, what do you see when you look at, say, the companies that are at the extreme end of innovation and the like? So we look at a company like Tesla as an example, not just in terms of what they're doing operationally, but when the board essentially authorizes putting $1.5 billion into Bitcoin. How does that change how you think about treasury at your companies when somebody does something like that and it's new?
Yeah, so this is the point about innovation. I mean, the one thing that is certain is that companies are not going to be stagnant, and there's a big risk that I certainly don't want to be at the helm on the board of a company that goes bankrupt. Nobody does. And indeed, you know, even I would go as far as to say I would rather that the company continues as a going concern and doesn't necessarily get acquired. Obviously, value is an issue we have to think about. But I like the example that you just picked about Bitcoin and Tesla. I actually have an article coming out in the next day or so in the Financial Times on this very point. I put my hand up. I'm the generation of skeptics. There are a lot of reasons to be skeptical about cryptocurrencies, partly because they are, you know, as a medium of exchange. If you look at the sort of three things that we tend to think about money, medium of exchange, unit of account, and store of value, really medium of exchange, it's hard to do a transaction. You know, the Visa takes 24,000 transactions, I think it is in a second or in a minute, something quite extreme. It takes, you know, 7 minutes to do something on Bitcoin. I might have the numbers roughly wrong, but they are in this article that I'm publishing. But then you also think about unit of account. There's too much volatility, so much volatility in Bitcoin, as an example. You can't really plan. You can't really think about price discovery and valuation when you've got so much underpinning the currency. But as a store of value, and my main point in the article is that companies can't ignore Bitcoin. You can't just be a skeptic and say, well, it's not going to happen, because we know our customers are using it. We know suppliers are using it. But also, and those are important arguments just as a hedge. But I think more fundamentally, it's really important for boards to think about what their role and their responsibility as companies is in an industry if they are not seen as a leader. So, for example, in your example that you just gave, Kevin, Tesla, you know, $1.5 billion is an enormous amount of money. If they turn out to be right, and this currency actually continues to appreciate, they have a bigger balance sheet. And with that, they can have much more flexibility and degrees of freedom in terms of acquisitions, in terms of how they play in the automobile sector, compared to a GM or Ford, as an example, who might not have cryptocurrencies on their balance sheet. I'm not therefore saying, oh, everybody should have cryptocurrencies, but I'm saying it's really incumbent on boards and corporations to think innovatively, not just in terms of the here and now, but really force themselves to think about long-term. What does this mean? How are we continuing to innovate? Are we going to be acquired? Are we going to acquire? You know, I was very struck by something that Jeff Bezos said. He doesn't think Amazon's going to be around in 30 years. You know, how can he say that? This is one of the most successful companies, but it's that kind of thinking. Like, how do you duck and weave constantly to make sure that you are really at the tip of the spear on these ideas and you are protected from whether it's a siloed world or innovation in cryptocurrency, but not just protected, as I said, in terms of risk, but also leaning into to opportunities. It's really critical. I will just say one last thing. We talked about race, gender, and diversity of ideas being important. This is what you've just discussed and raised here. It also shows that companies need to think a lot more about bringing in younger people into the boardroom as a way of bringing in new thinking and more cutting edge thinking in these areas.
And beyond these sort of individual cryptocurrencies led by Bitcoin, of course, on the other end of the spectrum, we're seeing, you know, China is moving aggressively on a central bank digital currency, and even, you know, Janet Yellen and Jerry Powell are talking about it as well. So a lot going on that front. I'm conscious of the time, so I have two very last questions for you. If you could answer quickly, it would be great, even though they probably require longer responses. But one is a board question, and then the other is your economist hat. The first is, you know, markets have been, you know, flying over the last, you know, we've been in a long upward swing aside from the blip in the spring of last year when we initially went into to lockdown. Money has been essentially free. And I'm just, you know, wondering how you on boards think about market conditions in terms of the price discovery mechanism that the market is fundamentally meant to present has kind of gotten lost with just this flood of money into the markets and everything going up. How does that concern you when it comes to kind of assessing where your company is?
Yes, absolutely. Just to put a broader point on this, about 15% of American companies are zombies. So by that, I mean they don't even have enough cash flows to cover the interest that they owe on debt. I think what that tells me is that a lot of companies are not running disciplined balance sheets. They're not running disciplined financials and possibly not even running disciplined operations. So yes, it looks on the surface very attractive at these rates to put more debt on your balance sheet. But for me, I'm looking at the broader, longer term perspective. What is that debt for? Are you going to generate the returns in a low growth environment? That's not just going to cover the debt payments that are going to be required, but thinking about dividends and share buybacks and importantly, reinvestment, because ultimately we cannot continue to have these companies. They won't thrive in an environment where they're not growing. So in a nutshell, what I'm saying, Kevin, is that what might look attractive in like low interest rates in the short term is something that has much more of a complex discussion around it to make sure that companies have that veracity to survive downdrafts that we just, you know, in a very surprising way experienced last year. These companies that are going to get taken over are not going to survive over the long term without massive bailouts are companies that I don't think have got that message right.
And my final question here is that tomorrow the Chinese National People's Congress convenes, and they are going to formalize both the 14th five-year plan and their long-range objectives, which includes surpassing the United States as the largest economy in the world by 2035. Is that going to happen?
Yes. However, I think about this with companies. I do think China is going to be the largest economy in GDP terms. The forecasts from the IMF and World Bank already show that that's the case. But the question is, does it really matter? There are a lot of, for me, I think much more about returns as opposed to size. There are a lot of companies, I think about Goldman Sachs, where I worked many years ago, which has always been relatively smaller in terms of its the number of employees, but in terms of returns, return on equity, for example, it's always posted better returns. So I don't think being bigger in of itself is an issue. I mean, obviously, as a juggernaut, it has a big role in politics and economics globally in terms of debt, et cetera, as we talked about. But I think the question is, what does this mean for returns and innovation, human living standards, that kind of thing? And I think the question is much more complicated.
I wish we had the time to unpack all of that, but hopefully you'll come back and we can do so. Dambisa Moyo's new book is How Boards Work. It's coming out in May. Dambisa, thank you so much for joining me today.
So there you have it. I'm Kevin Kachawara. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Teneo Insights. If you have any questions about any of the topics we cover, please reach out to us at teneoinsights@teneo.com. See you next time.